Hello and welcome to the Remembering Wildlife podcast series in partnership with This Wildlife. I'm your host, Amy Turner, and throughout this series, we will be talking with conservation organisations that have been supported by the funds raised by the groundbreaking Remembering Wildlife book series, founded by Margot Raggett. To date, the series has distributed more than $1.4 million to 68 different conservation projects in 31 countries across Africa, Asia, North and South America, and also into Europe. On this episode, we are focusing on the fastest land mammal on Earth, the cheetah. And the vast majority are found in sub-Saharan Africa, but there are also a very small population in Iran and also recently reintroduced to India, and we will touch on that in this episode. So on this episode, I am joined by Dr. Laurie Marker, founder of the Cheetah Conservation Fund, and Dr. Matt Becker, the CEO of the Zambian Carnivore Programme. Both are extraordinary individuals and organisations aiming to secure a future for a species that faces a multitude of threats. Now let's turn to our first guest, Dr. Laurie Marker. It's a true privilege to be able to talk with someone whose expertise and experience in cheetah conservation has no bounds, and I'm so excited to get a glimpse into the work of CCF, especially the Guarding Dog programme that has received funds from the Remembering Cheetahs book. So before we talk all about cheetahs and your work, I can see you're currently sat in a very big airy building. Please could you tell us where you're based? And it would be amazing to get a glimpse into what a day or a week looks like for you in terms of your work.
Well, hi, great. It's so lovely to be with you. And I am here in Otjiwarongo, actually outside of Otjiwarongo in Namibia, at the Cheetah Conservation Fund's Research and Education Center, which is our base for all the work that we do throughout Africa and around the world. And oh my gosh, there's never a dull day at CCF. For instance, this morning I was out trying to help vaccinate some horses that we have, wild horses out there. And that was quite an experience. But then yesterday we were working on a wild female cheetah that has actually been with us for a little over a month, who came in with some very severe wounds. And she's been healing up and getting her ready, we hope, in the next about week and a half to be able to release her back out into the wild. Our work really revolves around keeping cheetahs living free and in the wild. So if we do have animals come in, we have to help take care of them. And then beyond that, boy, I'm working together regularly with our team in Somaliland, where we also have a rescue and conservation center with over 90 cheetahs that have come in there from the illegal wildlife pet trade. And lots of groundwork going on there to try to stop the trade, working with communities, putting all of our educational materials into Somali language and trying to train the future farmers of Africa in that region to try to stop the trade. So that's a little bit about sort of what my days look like. I'm planning a big summit for cheetahs that is going to be happening in the Middle East in January. And I'm also working very closely with our partners to try to stop the demand on cheetahs in the Middle East. So my week is full, actually. And then sending people out to place some of our puppies from our livestock guarding dog program.
And Remembering Wildlife has been very pleased to have provided funds for the livestock guarding dog program that you mentioned just then, and the anti-cheetah cub trafficking work that you do in Somaliland. And before we delve into the specifics, let's shine a light on CCF's mission. Could you talk us through it?
Great. Yes. Our mission is to keep cheetahs living free and in the wild. And what we do is work from our base in Namibia throughout the cheetah's range and work in research and conservation initiatives and then also education. But our research really covers a variety of aspects from the biomedical side and genetic side, trying to understand more about the overall health and the genetic makeup of these wild populations, as well as that of understanding the ecology, how they live, using things like satellite collars to track the movements of the animals, and then working also using scat detection dogs and camera traps to find out, again, where the animals are living. And then from that, we use SCAP that comes into our genetics lab to extract, to look at the DNA, to also look at the overall, you know, population structures. Then we also, through our conservation programs, work, for instance, like with our Future Farmer of Africa and Future Conservationists of Africa programs. And we use livestock guarding dogs, which we breed and place and put out into communities to try to help protect the livestock from predators. So our training programs and our education programs are very, very critical. We are an open to the public research and education center. So we're busy these days also with visitors who are coming to Namibia, traveling through the country and learning more about conservation when they visit us in Namibia at our center.
I can't begin to imagine the logistics of such a wide range of programs, and it really sounds like a very complex operation, and we will come on to that. But first, let's talk about why cheetah are under threat. What are the key threats to cheetah that you're seeing?
Absolutely. So I think everyone knows that the cheetahs are the fastest land animal. But right now, they're actually racing against time. They are Africa's most endangered big cat. There are only about 7,000 cheetahs left in the world today. They're found in about 23 countries in 31 populations. And of those 31 populations, 20 of them have numbers less than 100 individuals. The problems facing them then are habitat loss and fragmentation, loss of prey, due to much of that, as well as human-wildlife conflict, because about 80% of the cheetahs left on Earth are found outside of protected reserves, which put them on the land with humans, their livestock, which is why we work a lot with the farming communities. And then also the illegal wildlife pet trade, where upwards to 200 to 300 animals a year are actually cubs, are being stolen from the wild illegally and then sold into the pet trade, primarily in the Middle East. And then the cheetah also is very unique in the fact that it is actually a survivor from the lack of genetic diversity. They went through a population bottleneck about 12,000 years ago, leaving them genetically very similar. And so all the animals that we are dealing with, all 7,000, are very close genetically. And that also causes a greater problem for them ecologically and environmentally.
Okay, that's fascinating. I had absolutely no idea about this genetic bottleneck. And what are the effects of a genetic bottleneck? Is it potentially a greater susceptibility of disease?
Well, it is. They're much more susceptible to disease. They're very monomorphic. And so if indeed they do see a different virus or disease similar to like the COVID in humans, cheetahs also have a coronavirus that can go through their population. And unfortunately, because they lack the genetic diversity, we see a very high mortality because it's very similar across all of their genes. But so health-wise, but also reproductive-wise. And so reproductively, we see about 70 to 80% abnormal sperm within males. And obviously, and that has been tied directly back into their lack of genetic diversity. We see high infant mortality rates. So there's a lot of different aspects that lacking genetic diversity actually plays a role in.
So moving on to the livestock guarding dog program, I'm fascinated about this. How do you train the dogs? What breed do you use? Why are they effective? And what is the process of integrating them as puppies into the communities?
Great. Well, it's always fun to talk about. And I set up the program back in 1994. So it is one of the longest livestock guarding dog programs in modern times, although these dogs have been used for over 5,000 years. And there's over 20 different breeds of livestock guarding dogs. And what the dogs do is different than what a herding dog does. A herding dog moves flocks. And what a guarding dog does is stands there and barks loudly, basically, if they see a predator and says, "I'm really big. And if you want to come and deal with my flock, you're going to have to come and talk to me." And we use the Turkish breed of dog, which is called the Anatolian Shepherd or the Kangal dog. And so the Kangal dog is actually the dog of Turkey. And they are amazing. We selected this breed because they do come from the Anatolian Plateau, which is a high desert, which has a very fluctuating temperatures. And here in Namibia, We are also in a high desert, which many people don't realize, that we can get down to below freezing in the winter and well above, you know, 100 degrees in the summer. So from that, they've got a short hair coat, and they also live in very large areas. And here we are a very vast grassland savanna ecosystem, and our flocks travel very far distances. So this breed of dog was also selected for that. Some of the other breeds of dog, which are also European, are used to being more around in the backyard farm, so to speak, to protect their livestock. This breed is used to vast movements, and they're also an independent thinker. They don't need a human to say, dog, come here and do that. The dog looks and says, human, you're pretty dumb. Maybe I should just do what I'm supposed to do, and I'll just, you know, figure that you're along with me. And so they're a very interesting breed of dogs, but they've been used, as I said, for over 5,000 years to protect livestock. And when we brought the dogs in originally to Namibia and then began a breeding program, we've now bred and placed over 750 of these dogs with the farming communities. Now, we place the dogs when they're about 10 to 12 weeks of age. And there is a window of time when the puppies are, they're born here in our goat yards. So we do also have a model farm, so we can also work with the farmers on best livestock management practices. But the dogs grow, are born in the goat yard, and then they go at about 10 to 12 weeks of age to their new farm, where they then bond with their flock. And when they're at about a year and a half of age, they are pretty much on their own taking care of their flocks. So there's this bonding period of time where, you know, under about 3 months, you want them to bond to their flock, and then that becomes theirs. And what is theirs, they then are protective of. And if they're protective of, then they're also going to guard and protect. And they will basically, as I said, bark very loudly. They mark territory, and predators know where they are. And predators, which most people don't understand, are not wanton livestock killers. They want an easy, quick meal. They don't want to do anything that's going to hurt themselves. And if they're around a livestock guarding dog, that dog could hurt them. And so barking and marking territory basically says to the predator, stay away. So through avoidance, the dogs work. And we see between a 80 to 100% success rate reduction of livestock loss to the farmers that have these dogs. Now, you'd mentioned, though, how do you train the dog? Well, the dogs have been doing this for 5,000 years, so intuitively they know what to do. We spend a lot of our time training farmers, but farmers don't want to be told that they're being trained. We work with them very closely for them to understand the behavior of the dogs so that they can interact with the dogs appropriately, so that the dogs continue to do a very good job. So usually their owner or the farm manager is the one who guides and watches how the dog is doing. So they're absolutely amazing.
Well, I must say the reduction of human cheetah conflict is absolutely staggering through one relatively simple technique, albeit once the dogs are fully integrated into their communities. It's absolutely fantastic to hear their success.
It's great. And then the farmers don't have to not only kill cheetahs, that the dogs are actually protecting all the other predators. So the jackals, the caracal, that of the leopard. So in all these areas, they're protecting all of these different animals. So the dogs are absolutely amazing. We then also spend a lot of time, you know, watching out for the dogs. We check them 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, and then annually thereafter. So we've got a very close relationship with the farmers, and know a lot about what they're doing. But also, we also neuter the dogs as well, so that the dogs are working and not out looking for mates. And so that's also, if you've got a working dog, then it's not going to lose its livestock. If it's not neutered, it can be out looking for mates and could lose its livestock. So all of those are parts of this project, which make it so important. So it's not just putting the dog out. It's a whole unit, which we tie in together with a program we call Future Farmers of Africa, which we work with the farming community very closely to understand that they play a very important role in the health of their livestock, in how they, you know, protect their young calves if they have breeding seasons, protecting their small stock. And so those are all tied into the work that we do.
Now, moving on to a topic that I find utterly horrific every time I talk about it, and that is the illegal wildlife trade, and specifically in this case, the trafficking of cheetah cubs out of Somaliland. I cannot imagine what you have had to witness and deal with over your career so far. Could you give us a window into this aspect of your work?
Yeah, it is. It's horrific because, and we've seen so much. And we began working in the Horn of Africa in around 2005. And by 2011, we were seeing an increase and trying to understand what was going on. By about 2018, we were then on the ground in the Horn of Africa. We have another base in Somaliland, which has become actually the front line to stop this illegal trade. And what's happening is the cubs are being caught, poached out of the wild. Either they'll track down a mother with her cubs and either chase the mother away and steal the cubs, or oftentimes kill the mother as well. The cubs then are trafficked and tried to get through Somaliland over into Yemen. And it's a very short cross over the Aden Peninsula area, and getting into Yemen is only like 100 kilometers, if that. Very, very short distance. And from there, then they're sold into the illegal trade into the Middle East for people who want them as pets. From everyone that might make it, four or five cubs die. And if one cub does make it, its life chances of living more than 2 years are maybe 1%. Most of them die under about a year or two because the people don't know how to take care of them. We see approximately for those that we have worked with the Ministry of Environment and Climate Change in Somaliland, right now we've got 92 cheetahs in Somaliland. We probably have had about a 50% mortality in the first few years. They come in totally malnourished, and most actually die within, you know, maybe hours of even us getting them. We have gotten very, very good working with the ministry and these confiscations, so that at this point we're down to maybe a 20% mortality. So things are improving. However, a lot of what we need to do is through awareness. And that's what we spend a lot of our time doing with now many staff members on the ground, working along the border of Ethiopia. We're also working in Ethiopia to also, and going south, because the animals are coming up from both Ethiopia. They're coming in from Somalia, from Puntland. And so we're working in all these different areas to try to spread awareness. We're training veterinarians on the ground and working with the wildlife departments in trying to really spread the word to stop the trade.
And the emotional effects of those working day in, day out with these situations is potentially overlooked, I think, in conservation sometimes. And from a personal perspective, how do you deal with the horrors that you witness from the illegal wildlife trade?
Well, I've been at this for such a long time, not only in Somaliland, but working with farmers who kill cheetahs for human-wildlife conflict. It affects me, but I think I have become maybe desensitized to protect myself. I've been through so much for so many years. My job is to try to protect my staff and the people on the ground who are new to this. And it's absolutely shocking. And you see these tiny cubs come in that are just a bag of bones. And it's very rewarding if we can save them and get them back into health. And the 92 cheetahs that we have living at our center now in Somaliland are doing very, very well, and we're very proud. But the amount of energy and time that's gone into caring for them has been absolutely amazing. And we've had to build an entire facility in Somaliland. We're now on 800 hectares with, you know, 92 cats and, you know, 20 huge compounds. Our compounds are, you know, 5 to 10 hectares. So they're very large, large areas. However, we've got to continually be building. We've got a big veterinary clinic, and, you know, nothing can come into Somaliland. It's the fourth poorest country in the whole world. And we've had to develop all of this and bring everything in from around the world to be able to develop like our veterinary clinic and build our pens. We've had to bring containers full of wire in from South Africa and our medical equipment from the UK and constant reagents and medicines that are coming from America, UK, and Namibia. So it's been a fascinating process that we've had to go through in order to save these animals and we hope stop the trade.
Well, I think this is a really good moment to say that on behalf of all of our listeners, just a massive thank you to you and your team for continuing to fight for the future of cheetah and going up against this trade. And if we look to the flip side then, what has been your proudest moment in your career so far with cheetah?
Well, potentially controversial, but we've just recently, a year ago, put cheetahs back into India, where they've been extinct for the last 70 years. And from this, after working for over 15 years on a project and a program, working very closely with the Indian government and researchers, we were able to actually bring the first 8 cheetahs into a reintroduction program last year. And then South Africa, which is one of our partners, joined with another 12 animals in February. So from that, we have been working very hard with the teams in India, South Africa, and Namibia ourselves in establishing this population. And, you know, with that, when you look at establishing a new population, one that's been extinct, a reintroduction, people love to hear about it, but not understanding that it is a very, very difficult job. And from that, there are losses and there are challenges. And so we have had a few losses there, but successful. We are very pleased with the overall success that we've actually had and the fact that the animals have been out. They've found and are establishing territories and are hunting. Always say they like the Indian food, which are the deer and antelope from India, which are a little bit different than those in Africa, but they run and they act the same way as our antelope do here, and the cheetahs have been hunting them very successfully. So it's part of a very long-term program that we're going to hopefully see success towards maybe in the next 5 to 10 years. So anytime you work in a rehabilitation project or reintroduction, it does take a lot of time, energy, and there are a lot of challenges, good and bad. So I think that would be probably one of the highlights. And we are looking at trying to place cheetahs in many of the other countries because, as I said, we're down to only 7,000 cheetahs. And from this, in the last 100 years, we've lost 20 countries where cheetahs once lived. And in the big vision, there is a potential that we could reestablish populations in some of these other countries. It will be hard, and we need to keep enough wild cheetahs living in the wild, and that's why our work in Namibia is so very important to keep the cheetahs living here. Namibia is called the cheetah capital of the world, and between Namibia and Botswana, we have about a third of the world's remaining cheetah population, so it's a very critical key populations that we're working on here.
That's a truly pioneering set of projects, and I'll be following the progress very carefully. And I think the word pioneering not only represents those projects, but also you personally. You're widely recognized as a world-leading expert on cheetah conservation. Where did your journey start, and where did the love of the species develop?
That's great. That's a great story. I would never have realized, living the 50 years of working with cheetahs that I have, that I would be here. And where did I start? I started in America. I ran a wildlife park in Oregon, which is called the Wildlife Safari. And it was 600 acres with kind of free-ranging animals. And we had large camps, one of which had cheetahs. And back in the early 70s, nobody really even knew what a cheetah was. There was a handful of living in captivity. And I was fascinated when I first saw a cheetah. I was running the veterinary clinic at that point in time and wanted to know everything there was about the cheetahs. And so the director said, great, find out what you can. And as I wrote to people around the world, people wrote back to me. And back in those days, of course, you had to mail letters out. And people would write back and they'd say, we don't know very much about cheetahs. They don't breed well in captivity. Very few of them are found in captivity. We're losing them in the wild. They have a very short lifespan and they don't breed. So good luck. And that started me off on trying to find out everything that I could about the cheetah. And in the middle 1970s, I had an opportunity to do a research project where I took a cheetah that had been born in captivity to Namibia, whose actually parents had come from Namibia originally. And I brought her here to find out if a captive-born cheetah could learn how to hunt. And I did teach her how to hunt, but what I found out was that farmers were killing cheetahs like flies, like 800 to 900 a year. And during the 1980s, when I was trying to figure out traveling around other areas of Africa, what could be done to help save the wild cheetahs, the farmers here in Namibia had killed almost 10,000 individuals. So something needed to be done. And in 1990, I set up the Cheetah Conservation Fund. I was working at that point at the Smithsonian. I'd moved from the wildlife safari after developing in Oregon the most successful breeding program for cheetahs in all of North America. But we still never knew anything about what a free-ranging, wild, healthy animal looked like. There were so few of them. And that was one of my big tasks when I came here to Namibia, was to find out more about the overall biology, genetics, and ecology of the cheetah. And so basically I've done the groundwork, the pioneering groundwork on all of the basic overall health, biology, home ranges, of anything that you start with from the cheetah. And then from there, trying to put together applied conservation, which were strategies around how to stop the killing from the farming communities and how to better keep the cheetahs living free and in the wild. So again, here at the center in Namibia, we've got a genetics laboratory, a veterinary clinic, of course, a model farm. We also are part of a conservancy where Namibia is one of the leading countries in the world, I think, for conservation of their wildlife. And I've been on the ground floor of all of this because I started here in Namibia at its independence in 1990. And so we are a very long-standing conservation organization and are very, very proud of the work that we've done in conjunction with the Namibian government and now working with several other governments throughout all of Africa. I've trained people from most of the cheetah range countries. They've come here to Namibia to learn. And from that, we're trying to establish programs in those other countries. There's 23 countries where cheetahs are, to try to help save cheetahs in those countries as well.
Well, Laurie, what a brilliant way to end the episode. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been an absolute privilege to be able to talk with you, and you've provided a window into the world of the fastest land mammal, and your enthusiasm and wealth of knowledge for the species is truly inspiring. So thank you very much, and I wish you and your team all the best at CCF.
Thank you. We're really proud of the support that we've gotten from Remembering Wildlife. The book is beautiful. Everybody involved in it has been wonderful. And we really appreciate the awareness and support that's given to us. Thank you.
So if we now turn across to Zambia and our second guest, Dr. Matt Becker, the CEO of the Zambian Carnivore Programme, an outstanding organisation that works day in, day out in a multifaceted approach to protect cheetah and other carnivores in Zambia. I'm very excited to be joined by Matt today to hear about the Zambian Carnivore Programme and also hear how a donation from the Remembering Cheetahs book has supported an impressive anti-snaring programme. So Matt, before we delve into your work, it's always fascinating to understand what the day-to-day life of a conservationist is like for our guests. And on that note, what has been going on in the past week or so for you and your team?
Thank you, Amy, and a pleasure to be here on your podcast. And again, thanks very much for the opportunity to showcase the support of the Remembering Wildlife series. The last week here in Zambia, we work across the country, so it's a little variable depending on the ecosystem you're talking about. But I am on the eastern side of the country at the moment, and we are currently nearing the height of the hot, dry season. So that is when the rains are about 2 months away, and everything has really dried down. and animals are getting very concentrated around the perennial water points throughout the ecosystems. In this case, it's the Loango River is where everyone's focusing because that's some of the only water in the place. And it makes for some of the most dramatic wildlife viewing in the country. And so our teams are out working all days and throughout the year with locating animals, in this case, wild dogs and lions and hyenas primarily, and collecting critical information on these groups. We follow almost 500 individuals intensively in this area, and also making sure that some of the primary threats, such as snares, are being addressed through collaborative work that I think we're going to discuss. And so, yeah, it's an exciting time. It's a very busy time. We sometimes refer to it as the top of the roller coaster from here until when the rains start. It's pretty manic. And but yet at the same time, some of the most exciting and rewarding work we do all year.
So there's clearly a vast amount of diversity in your work, and I can't wait to get into that. Now, on this episode, we're focusing predominantly on cheetah, but before we dive into the cheetah-specific conservation work, please could you start by talking about the overall work and mission of the Zambian Carnival Program, and what areas do you operate in?
Sure. The Zambian Carnivore Program, and for those of you who aren't familiar with program terminology, a program is a collection of projects. And so we have five different projects across the country. We're 100% field-based, so we are, our headquarters are here in the Loango in our field project, and then we work in the greater Kafue ecosystem, which is sort of, it's centered around the one of the largest national parks in Africa, the Kafue National Park. And then we work in Western Zambia in the greater Lua ecosystem on the border of Angola, the Kabompo ecosystem with West Lunga National Park in Northwestern, and then also in collaboration with partners, Frankfurt Zoological Society up in Sumbu on the southern edge of Lake Tanganyika in northern Zambia. And so we're a nonprofit working closely with the country's wildlife management authority, the Department of National Parks and Wildlife, and I think over 30 some partners across the country to achieve our mission, which is to conserve large carnivores and ecosystems through a four-pronged organizational approach. Firstly, we are a science-based organization, so conservation science forms some of the fundamental work that we do. And so that's mainly based at identifying and evaluating the impacts of the various threats facing large carnivores and ecosystems, not just in Zambia, but range-wide across the continent. Now, if we just identified and evaluated those threats, that would not be sufficient to have as much of an impact as possible. And so our second organizational pillar is conservation action. So that's a whole array of actions as identified by our science. And that can range from work on anti-snaring, combating the bushmeat trade, illegal trafficking, protection of habitat and connectivity, and large landscape conservation. And then thirdly, an increasing aspect of our work and a new aspect that has recently been developed is our coexistence focus. And so that's decreasing the costs and increasing the benefits of for people living with wildlife. And so really the communities that are in and around these protected area networks where large carnivores are usually are the ones bearing the costs of living with carnivores and not always realizing the benefits, primarily economic, but also nature-based services. And so decreasing the cost primarily in the form of carnivore conflict mitigation and increasing the benefits through a, array of work that we do with partners and with community outreach and education work. And then lastly, and probably most importantly, is our conservation leadership pillar. And so there are not a lot of opportunities historically for someone in Zambia interested in field-based conservation of this sort to get experience, much less pursue a career in that. And so we have an array of training programs beginning in the primary school level all the way up through the PhD level, and various programs ranging from women and wildlife conservation training programs, conservation biologists, wildlife vet, professional development, integrated field conservation courses, and supporting a whole variety of training and educational opportunities. And so that's really what's going to make this work sustainable in the long term, and having it as locally led as possible.
And if we look to the cheetah conservation specifically, they are a species under enormous threat. Could you tell us about the anti-snaring initiative that you run? It'd be so interesting to hear about this work, especially since, excitingly, one of the donations from the Remembering Cheetah book have gone towards supporting it.
Yes, definitely. So, yes, cheetah are one of the focal species that we study, and those are in two main ecosystems, the Greater Kafue ecosystem, which is the largest population, and then a recovering population in the Greater Lua ecosystem. And so we have worked on both of those populations for over a decade. And in many areas range-wide for cheetahs and other carnivores, the bushmeat trade is perhaps one of the biggest threats to carnivores. Now, I think the importance of bushmeat impacts, and for those of you who aren't familiar with what bushmeat is, it's basically wild game meat that's illegally harvested through poaching. And this sort of work that I'm going to describe is obviously not going to comprise a solution to resolving the bushmeat trade. Obviously, there needs to be a number of different actions ranging from improving community conservation models that maximize benefits from wildlife, having a legal source of bushmeat in many areas that do not, and changing a variety of policies around those. But at the same time, these things take many years, if not decades, to change policies and implement models. And so there are things changing, particularly on the population level for large carnivores, such that you need methods that address immediate threats while longer-term solutions are being designed and implemented. And so it was very clear to us in the work with cheetahs that they were being impacted by snares. And so snares are typically made of wire. They're nooses that can be set passively or actively triggered, usually for antelope species, and set on game trails or around water holes and things. And so large carnivores can be actively targeted with these, but in most of our areas, they become victim of what we call bycatch. And that's a fisheries term for non-targeted catch. So no one is currently snaring typically for these species versus they become accidentally caught. So whatever wanders in to these snares can either become entangled in them and die, or break free and have some pretty serious injuries as a result. And so most of the remaining populations of cheetah, they're an IUCN listed species of concern. We hope they have more status. Amongst colleagues, we are pushing for an uplisting of them to endangered, given their status. But outside of the stronghold populations in East Africa and some parts of Southern Africa, particularly Namibia, most cheetah populations live in very small, often fragmented populations, usually of under 100 individuals. And that's likely to characterize definitely Lua, possibly Kafue, in that they're very small. And so they're low density, wide ranging, really tough to estimate and evaluate. And snares can have the immediate impact of bycatch. So a cheetah gets caught in one. If it doesn't die, its ability to hunt and much less reproduce is severely compromised. And so it was very clear with our work that snaring was one of the biggest impacts on survival. And in fact, I think in Lua, it was the major cause of adult mortality over the years. And in Kafui, it accounted for about a third of mortality. So, and that's what we know. A lot of times a cheetah might just disappear and might be near an area that's of high snaring risk. And we can suppose that was a possibility that it died in a snare, but a lot of times we don't know, so we may be underestimating it. And so our work with that, I think, hopefully reflects a merging and integration of conservation science and action. Is very little is known about these populations, and they're incredibly difficult to evaluate given the challenges I mentioned. And so by studying them, we utilize radio collars on cheetah. Obviously, we're not collaring everyone, but have collars on select individuals, such as breeding females or a male in a coalition. So males typically have coalitions of 1 to 3 individuals. And so we're able to follow them across these vast landscapes. So these are really big landscapes, really challenging to monitor. And so there's really no way you could follow these animals without that technology. And that was some of the work that was supported by our Remembering Cheetahs support. And so our teams are out there regularly following up and locating these animals. And so that provides the actual knowledge of what is facing the cheetah. What are the major threats? What are the dynamics of the population what are the impacts of it? But also when we had animals snared, we have a field-based vet that we have a Zambian vet in every project of the 3 long-term projects in the Luangwa, Lua, and Kafui. And when an animal was snared, we had the ability to go out and de-snare them. Similarly, though, the collar data would let us know when animals were in a high-risk area, and both our presence out there locating the animal and monitoring it, but equally, if not more importantly, was providing these locations to law enforcement. So we don't conduct law enforcement, but our partners do, and that can range from African Parks, the DMPW, and Musakesi Conservation, and Panthera in the case of Kafui. And so we provide those to law enforcement partners, these locations, for areas of high risk and high use. And so the combination of having a field-based presence able to monitor cheetah groups, a vet that is able to quickly respond to snare cheetah and dart and treat them, and a means of providing law enforcement with directed information to direct patrols into areas of high snaring risk has been the core of our field-based protection work with cheetahs. And that's some of the support that we got from Remembering Wildlife. That was a very long-winded answer, so I apologize. It's a fairly complex program, so I wanted to make sure to articulate it reasonably.
Absolutely, and thanks very much for talking us through that. I think the word holistic springs to mind in terms of that approach. And the funds have also supported other predators, such as the training of the future Zambian lion conservationists, as well as outreach to local communities. And this is something I'm personally quite interested in. So please, could you talk us through this?
Yeah, again, it probably won't be a quick answer, so I'll try to be as brief as possible. For this work, when we were starting out, it was and the whole program was founded by a woman named Kelly Lee down in Lower Zambezi National Park, with an initial focus on wild dogs, and that's broadened. I think the team now is over 70 people, and over 85% of the team is from here in Zambia, and we are always working to increase that. And yeah, the leadership training work is, as I mentioned, arguably the most important component of our work, because all of this conservation work requires not only really passionate people leading the charge with it, but also having the ability to receive specialized training and education. That's really difficult to get, and it's still very difficult to get. If you are, for example, a university graduate here in Zambia, and I think this is reflective of most places in Africa, say you want to go into field-based conservation, there are very few opportunities to receive that sort of training and education. And so we've worked with a variety of educational partners over the years and continue to refine our programs. And so the leadership training kind of encapsulates all the different programs that we talked about in the initial description. But I think some of the most specialized training are the women in wildlife conservation, the conservation biologist, wildlife vet training programs. And those are some of the programs that Remembering Lions and Remembering Wild Dogs support has funded. And Women in Wildlife, when we started working in that program, was implemented by a woman who is currently managing our Luangwa project, Tendiwe Mwetwa, and she was one of the few women in the program. It's was mainly a male-dominated field. And so we started bringing on trainees that were closely mentored by people like Tendiwe. So you'd have a senior ecologist or a project manager, and the trainees would come in and learn all the aspects of the work. And I think that's where it's so important to have someone attached in the field, because you can learn about the theory and practice in university, but actually getting on the ground, getting out in the field, actually seeing the study animals, knowing how to conduct the work, that's so important. And equally important is knowing, you know, how to manage field work. And that can range from knowing how to drive a vehicle. Most people don't have driver's license, much less experience smashing around in the bush in a Land Rover. And so these are all, and much less learning how to fix it. And so these are all practical field skills that people learn. And so we've had a whole bunch of different trainees through the years, and increasing that, not just in Zambia, but now we're, as part of our strategic plan in 2022, the next 5 years, we're really looking at leveraging our impacts with partner organizations that are locally based throughout the continent, and seeing how we can each offer the training to each organization and government agencies. And so we've worked with a lot of different organizations in Tanzania, Angola, Kenya, Benin, Ethiopia, and sharing what we know from our long-term projects and learning from these projects and individuals as well. And so Remembering Lions and Remembering Wildlife Series in general has been a key component of that support. And just as an example, last year, I think we had 48 trainees across those four programs. And that was a record. And actually every year, kind of like climate change, every year is a more, it's a higher number. So that's a good thing. And we're real proud of that. And I think it's, it continues to feed off itself, in that there's a unprecedented interest in Zambia in this work, and that's that is noticeable from the early years. And I think that's entirely due to the mentors and leaders that we have both on the team and people who have gone through the training program and taken positions in other partner organizations and in the government. I think we've had trainees go on to about 13 different organizations and agencies within the country that have gone through the program. So I think it's one of the most impactful things we can do, and we're really excited about continuing to grow it.
What an effective model that is, and I'm sure the benefits will be reaped in the decades to come. Your work must be extremely rewarding, but also challenging. And on that note, what has been the biggest challenge you faced whilst working in the field?
That's a good question. As we always joke, there's no shortage of challenges here. And I think that goes for this work in general. It's always challenging. If it wasn't, I think we would have found effective solutions for a lot of these things long ago. And so, but anything worth doing is usually challenging. And I think to me, it's easy to get overwhelmed and despondent about not just things happening here with the work, but overall, I think, on the planet, there's a lot of different challenges. There's a lot of problems. And if you think too much about it, you can think it's quite a grim outlook on many respects. But so I think the challenge is every day, you know, getting up and going to work and making sure that you can, you know, keep optimistic about it and keep moving forward. And there are many days when you do not move forward at all. You move many steps back. And that's just kind of the way it is. But over the long term, when you look back, you see that a lot of progress has been made. But really the thing that keeps me going, and I think you speak for a lot of people, is just knowing that you're not alone doing this. There's great people doing amazing work all across the country, all across the region, all across the continent, and really all across the world. And, we obviously need to increase the number of people doing the work, but it's just encouraging to know wherever you look, be it conservation or be it some other form of service to humanity and the planet, that there are people doing good things everywhere.
And I'm so interested to know, what is it that you're most proud of throughout your career so far in relation to cheetah conservation?
Yeah, I think, we, together with partners, we started the first projects on cheetahs with the department and African Parks and others. And I think that was no small feat. And so there's a lot of things that we're proud of on that. But ultimately, at the end of the day, one of my mentors always said, it's not what you do, it's who you train. And I think that is by far what I'm most proud of, is the people that are conducting the work right now and will be conducting it into the future, and who are the real leaders of the work and the leaders in cheetah conservation. And so undoubtedly that's what I think I'm most proud of.
And lastly, and I'm pretty sure you may include some of your last answer in this, but what gives you hope for the future of cheetah, lion, and our other big cats?
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's seeing the passion, interest, and potential and the work that people are already doing, not just in Zambia, but throughout the range of cheetah, and knowing that, you know, cheetah conservation is in great hands going forward, and that hopefully we were a part of that in some small way, both in Zambia and for the species as a whole. I think there's some amazing individuals up and coming conducting this work across the continent, and I'm just really excited to see where they take it.
Well, what a fantastic half an hour that was. So many interesting approaches to solving the problems facing cheetah. And thank you so much for your time. It really has been a pleasure to hear about your work today. And it looks like the future of conservation in Zambia is in good hands with the young conservationists coming through. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, Amy. And it's been a pleasure to be a part of this. And I also just wanted to put in a word for Remembering Wildlife and just say what an amazing initiative it has been, and so impactful, and that all of the work we've been discussing is not possible without the support of Remembering Wildlife and others. And so I just, on behalf of the organization and the work and the cheetahs and wild dogs and lions and all of that, we're just extremely grateful to be a part of the Remembering Wildlife series. And that is something that is really changing the game for these species. So thanks again.
You've been listening to the Remembering Wildlife podcast series in partnership with This Wildlife. If you'd like to get your hands on any of the stunning Remembering Wildlife books, please head to rememberingwildlife.com. We are This Wildlife Podcast, and we're here to bring the wild to you.